annual Laurel Street Fair on Saturday, August 13th. To sign up to be a volunteer or learn more, please visit us at laurelstreetfair.com.
This is a benefit for the Laurel District Association.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for About Health.
Good afternoon and welcome to About Health. In 2014, it was reported that close to 16 million adults in the United States had at least one major depressive episode. That's almost 7% of all U.S. adults. One study also showed that up to 15% of children and adolescents have some symptoms of depression. You know, in teens, it's often difficult for parents to spot, since depression can be confused with behaviors and feelings that are typical of puberty and adolescence. When a teen is moody or irritable, it can be due to a lack of sleep, too much homework, or a real general feeling of overwhelm. People often suffer from depression in silence because there's still stigma about mental illness or emotional problems. There is still shame. There are also many people who can't afford treatment and don't know how to get the help they need, and so they suffer alone. I'm Nurse Rona, your host twice a month here to explore different concepts of health and well-being. Today we'll talk about what to do if you're depressed, what treatments are available, and what lifestyle changes are possible to increase your happiness and sense of ease. We'll open up the phone line soon to take your calls. Let us know what has helped you when you've been depressed. You can call us toll-free, 1-800-958-9008, or in the area code 510, you can call us at 848-4425. Joining me in studio is Dr. Tarai Garchitorena Kanishi. She's a naturopathic doctor who offers integrative programs for treating anxiety, panic, depression, insomnia, chronic stress, autoimmune conditions, and chronic fatigue. She serves clients all over the world via phone and video consultations. Dr. Tarai has spent most of her life exploring what it means to be truly happy and well. She's done research and energy work with Tibetan nuns in India, worked in sustainable agriculture in the Philippines, and became a lifelong student of Eastern and Western spirituality. She's also certified in hypnotherapy and neuro-linguistic programming. You can learn more about her at deeplyhappy.com. Dr. Tarai, welcome to KPFA.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's really good to see you. I see you on your blog and on the website, and now I see you in person.
Yeah, it's good to see you in person.
Also with us is Dr. David Frankel. He's a clinical psychologist in Berkeley and Corte Madero, California. He has expertise helping people struggling with depression, anxiety, mood disorders, ADHD, school problems, and relational difficulties. He's been in practice for over 20 years, and he's been the program director of Ross Hospital's Children and Adolescent Inpatient Unit. He has supervised psychology trainees at the Wright Institute here in Berkeley and led a child consultation group for A Home Within, an organization that provides free psychotherapy to children in foster care. Dr. Frankel is on the Child Colloquium Committee of the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis, and you could learn more about his work at davidfrankelphd.com. And I have that information also at my website at nurserona.com. David Frankel, welcome to About Health.
It's great to be here.
Really nice. I'm so glad I met you recently. That was great. So I'm going to start with you, David. You work with children. You've worked with children, teens, and adults who suffer with depression in varying degrees. Maybe you can start us off with a real overview of what depression is and what it isn't.
Yeah, thanks. That's a really valuable distinction to make. You know, what depression is a condition. Some would call it a disease. I think that's up for debate, but it, you know, it can be understood that way. where, you know, there's a loss of pleasure in everyday activities. There's a loss of energy. There can be anger and irritability, self-destructiveness. Some conceive it as kind of one turning on oneself. I do think it's useful to think about depression also as actually not necessarily being a unitary concept, but being could be many depressions. There are many various causes for it. So some of the things I'm going to say might apply to certain people, but not to others. A lot of times, people who are depressed have difficulty distinguishing it from grief, because grief is a normal process that we all go through when we lose something that is important to us, a loved one, a relationship, a pet, even a career, whatever. I mean, in that situation, it often looks very much like depression. There could be a loss of pleasure in things, sadness, tearfulness, irritability, difficulty concentrating. Even feelings of transient self-destructive behaviors and things like that. The difference between depression and grief, though, is that oftentimes grief is kind of self-limiting, and that after a period of time, you kind of return to the world, you've given up the thing you've grieved somewhat, although it's always with you, and you can kind of return to functioning, whereas depression can go on much longer, sometimes indefinitely.
That's a really good distinction. I think it's an important one, and I think in our culture too, we don't realize sometimes how long grief goes on. You know, when you lose, say, a partner of 50 years, you know, the person who's still here might be grieving for a good year or two, in a way that's disorienting, and they may have a lot of the symptoms of depression. But I think that's when it's always useful to talk to someone. But we also have to differentiate that kind of sadness that's due to a circumstance. And again, it's complicated sometimes because we live in a world where there's a lot sometimes to be, you know, grieving over.
And, you know, I think sometimes there's an intolerance of grieving and negative affects. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I would want to say, you know, as a matter of our discussion is, you know, feeling depressed, having upset, you know, feeling sad and tearful, and that's a part of life, and that, you know, it's a part of living. And so just because at times we don't feel well, it does not necessarily mean that we're in a depressed state. And sometimes in order to be happy, it's important to tolerate grief.
Right. So I think one of the things maybe we'll get to is how do people suddenly realize that, oh, this is something else, and this is something I need support for. So we'll certainly keep talking about that. Dr. Turai, in your work, you've talked about inflammation and how it relates to both depression and heart disease, which I found really interesting to read about. Maybe you could give also a brief overview of how you view depression.
Yeah, that's a really good place to start, I think. You know, in the same way that heart disease used to be considered a heart issue, you know, a heart organ problem, but that's a very outdated way of looking at heart disease now. We now know that the entire body is involved. There are systemic markers of inflammation that are directly correlated with how bad or how high a risk for heart disease is. And as it happens, the same marker that has been used for heart disease prediction is one of the few biochemical markers that have actually also been associated with depression.
And which marker is that?
That's CRP.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so correlated. And in fact, they found that when people, research subjects were given an anti-inflammatory medication along with their mood meds, they had a better response or a better improvement in mood compared to those that just received mood meds. So it actually creates a really powerful clinical correlation between controlling inflammation and the treatment of depression. And we can do that in so many ways beyond simply, you know, giving an anti-inflammatory medication, which has a lot of issues in its own, by itself.
And that's some of what we'll get into, some of the ways you help treat people through reducing inflammation in other ways. But if you're talking to a client, how do you explain to them what depression is? How do you even talk about what that means? Do you look at it in a clinical way, or are you looking at more about a person's sense of their life and meaning in their life and mood?
Mm-hmm. You know, I like to say that symptoms are signals and feelings are feedback. And so, mm-hmm. you know, if you're experiencing something, whether it be related to your mood, a depressive state, or fatigue, or anything else really, it's always a sign that something needs to change. something needs to be shifted. You know, having experienced depression myself, I've come to understand it in many ways as a sort of calling to begin something that is different, you know, to go on a journey, whether it's an emotional journey, a spiritual journey, a wellness journey. So it's a sign, you know, something needs to shift. The way things have been going thus far are not working, is not working.
So it's really about really tuning in to, you know, how I am and what I need
yes.
to make that shift.
Yes.
I think that's a really important distinction.
And getting the right support as well.
And getting the right support. I think I'm going to go ahead. I have so many more questions for both of you, but I'm going to go ahead and take a call since we have someone calling us now, and then we'll just continue from wherever this conversation leads us. There's so much to talk about. We have Elise with us on the line from Hayward. You're on About Health.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I just wanted to say, you know, like, I've been struggling with depression for several years now, and I think that, you know, the talking about anti-inflammatory, having, like, an anti-inflammatory diet, that's been the thing that honestly made a change for me the most.
That made a big difference for you, you said?
Sorry, what was that?
I'm sorry, I had trouble hearing you. That made a big difference for you, the anti-inflammatory diet?
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What did you notice, Elise?
It's just kind of like there was a fog before. I guess that's the best way to describe it.
A fog.
Yeah, and just watching what I ate. Being a lot more clean, I noticed that my body felt better. I felt more focused, and I think that really helped me put my priorities in check. You know.
Yeah, I think that's great that you called in to tell us that because it's so interesting. For other reasons, I started an anti-inflammatory diet for some of my arthritis, and I notice a huge shift also in my energy. Did you have a question, or should we just let our guests here respond to that, Elise?
Oh, yeah, just go ahead. I just wanted to add it.
Yeah, great. I'm glad you called. I appreciate that very much. David, you know, because you're a clinical psychologist and different than Tarai here, it's not your usual probably way of treatment to talk about diet, but do you, I guess is my question.
You know, yes. I mean, in the sense that I think one of the problems of depression is a problem of regulation of one's mood. And I would also say that there are many, many paths to health and that I do not believe that we understand all the reasons biochemically, environmentally, psychologically, why people become depressed. So my feeling as a psychologist, even though I do primarily talk therapy, is that nobody has the monopoly on helping people or health and wellness, and that, you know, it's generally a multitude of interventions that make a difference in somebody's life.
And I would imagine that if someone has tried different things and they don't work, they might also feel even more disappointed, feeling like they can't figure out what to do. And that's where you have to have such a broad palette of different colors to use when you work with people because different things work for different people, for sure.
Absolutely. There are many, I think depression has many different causes and that, I don't think there's any one answer to it.
Yeah. Before I ask you about that, Terry, let me just say, what are some of the causes? There's neurobiology and
right.
heredity and...
Yeah, I mean, there's the biological causes, which I think, you know, are fairly clear. I also think that, you know, trauma can lead to depression. I think that a lack of existential meaning in one's life can lead to depression. I think that intrapsychic conflict, you know, and over someone being too hard on themselves through, you know, guilt and things like that and having a very harsh conscience can lead a person to become depressed. I think anxiety and depression are very closely linked, and sometimes people who are quite anxious, you know, become depressed as a consequence, or they're kind of intertwined with each other.
Yeah.
And I also think as a consequence of recovery from from long-term substance abuse, that a lot of times those things either go together, or the kind of grieving process of kind of reentering one's life after something like that can lead a person to feel quite depressed.
Good. That's very useful. So, Tarai, in terms of her experience of having gone on an anti-inflammatory diet and feeling better, do you want to say a little bit more about why that works?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of mysteries as to the exact why, but what we're finding in terms of practically all chronic diseases across the spectrum, a lot of them are very well addressed with a diet that's anti-inflammatory in nature, because with a common therapeutic target of chronic disease tends to be inflammation. It's true for cancer, heart disease, autoimmune, and depression. And so when you go on an anti-inflammatory diet, you are naturally dialing down that exact feature that seems to trigger a lot of these chronic issues. You know, I think, you know, various people will have different chronic issues based on what I like to think of as your weak link. You know, we all have our weak link. For some people, it's the joints. For some people, it's, you know, depending
on the gut.
Yeah, the gut, or depending on your heredity. And for some people, it'll manifest in depression or anxiety or more serious mental health issues. And so an anti-inflammatory diet, which in general, just for those of you who aren't familiar with what that even means, you know, it starts with some basics that, you know, wherein you remove, for example, highly processed foods, sugar, those are big ones, and then increase your intake of vegetables and fruit and high-quality protein. That's a really, really good foundation of an anti-inflammatory diet. And then the next level of that is, are there specific foods that you are sensitive to? And that's where the gluten and the dairy, the nightshades for some people come in. So it's very simple in a lot of ways. It's just common sense in terms of a clean diet. And then there's some tweaking that can be done. It's so powerful for trying to get off any meds or avoid any meds. And again, that's not something you do lightly. I always recommend people work closely with their psychiatrist if they want to change their medication in any way. And having a great diet is a great foundation for feeling better regardless of whether you're on meds or not.
That's right. Very, very important to say. We're talking about depression. Well, what is it? What is it not? How have you treated it? What questions do you have? We have two excellent guests here in studio with us. You can call us toll-free at 1-800-958-9008. Let's take another call. We have Amadou from San Francisco.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
I'm just calling to see what your guests might have in as far as their opinions about pharmaceuticals, specifically like Abilify, Escitalopram, and I guess it's a two-part question. How valid do, you know, people in power look at depression if you're not taking some kind of a pharmaceutical?
How do people, when you say in power, do you mean the medical,
like,
professionals?
Those people along with, you know, the psychiatric community and psychological community.
Good
because
question.
They're both two different schools of thought.
Yeah.
And,
good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
You're asking two important questions because, you know, I was just thinking, I was watching yesterday when I was watching TV while I was cooking, and I was just noticing how many ads there are for psychiatric medications along with diabetes medication. But I was flawed again about how we are told all the time that we should take medication. And my own feeling is I've known people who have really benefited from medication, and it's made a huge difference in their life. And I know many people who have dealt with their depression or anxiety or other ADHD or other issues without medication, and they've done so well. So I'm glad you asked, and I want to see what
the other thing is, like, you know, what about people who are truly disabled,
right,
who can't get a validation for the diagnosis unless they're taking psychotropics,
right,
or psychopathy.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, thank you for asking those questions. Let me start with you, David Frankel.
Yeah, I would say, you know, you're asking a very important question, and I share Rona's feelings that, you know, I'm a clinical psychologist, so I don't prescribe medications. My mode of helping people is through talk therapy. And I would say I'm an informed skeptic when it comes to medications, that I've seen people really helped by them. I've been personally helped by them. But I also think that for a lot of people, it's best to try other therapies first and see if they work. With regard to Abilify in particular, that's not really a medication that's used as a first-line treatment for depression. It's more of a mood stabilizer and for other disorders. And so one of the things that I believe very strongly in terms of medications is you've got to have a very accurate diagnosis and have a good sense of what and why you're using a medication. And to really use it after other therapies maybe haven't been helpful, or if a condition is so debilitating that you really feel that that's the direction you need to go in.
And I hear something in what he was asking, too, about maybe... you know, you're not taken seriously if you're not on medication.
You know, that's a good question. And I would say from my perspective, that is not how I feel at all. And then I think the issue of medication and the issue of are you suffering, do you need help, what is your diagnosis, those are two very separate things. And if anything, it flows in the other direction from, you know, really understanding what's going on in a person's life to then... You know, maybe medications are part of the treatment, maybe they're not, but if you're not on a medication, that doesn't mean that you don't have a valid diagnosis.
Well, and how our system fails us in this country is that very often the person who doesn't have means and isn't financially well off in a sense, you know, doesn't always find a medical professional who they feel is listening or who they can trust. You know, there are services for low income or even middle income people available, but there's a big struggle of figuring out who do I trust making this diagnosis? Are they listening to me? Are they paying attention? Are they seeing me for more than 10 or 15 minutes? So we do have a lot of issues when it comes to making that accurate diagnosis. Is there anything else you wanted to say, Chirai?
Yeah, I think the trust piece is really valuable to consider. There's a lot of, you know, we can talk all day about how the medical system is failing in a lot of ways. And because, you know, a lot of doctors don't have enough time with their patients, you know, many people are given diagnoses that are not accurate or are given medications when it's not appropriate. And at the same time, you don't want to discount the reality that for some people, meds do have that stabilizing effect that some people need, if only as a bridge between, you know, everything else they need to do to get better or lifelong. You know, there's such a thing as a therapeutic order where I like to tell my patients, you know, we want to use the gentlest medicine that works. So it has to work. You know, if you can do something very gentle, but if it's not effective, it's not good medicine. So it has to include medications, but definitely not as an only resort.
And I bet in your practice, sometimes people will come who want to get off a medication.
Yes.
And then you try and help them with, I would imagine, diet, exercise, sleep, supplements,
right,
things like that. Is that part of what you do?
It is. I mean, there's what I have is, you know, I call it the three keys to becoming deeply happy, and this is something that I always use as a framework for anyone coming in and wants something different. The three keys are, you know, having a sense of purpose and meaning. The other is wellness, and the other is having strong interpersonal relationships. And so anytime someone comes to me and wants help beyond medication, you know, we're always looking at which of these three is strong in you. You know, that's what's powerful in you. That's one of your strengths that you can build on. And then what needs more support? And then we go from there, right?
Yeah. I would imagine that's similar to what you do, David.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny listening to you. That's exactly the way I think also, yeah, is like what's a person's, you know, connectedness with other people? Do they have a sense of meaning? How do they regulate themselves? What's their physical health like? And, you know, if those things, sometimes they may have one or two things that are working, but one is really not, and they're very unhappy.
Right. Yeah, right. And build on that. We're talking about depression today. You can call us at 1-800-958-9008. Let's take another call now. We have Diane from Petaluma with us. You're on About Health.
Hi. Very interesting topic today because I have had a history of chronic major depression, anxiety, and PTSD for over 20 years. And I've been in therapy for that long a period of time. And I've taken just about every medication known to mankind, from the earlier ones to the latest, and they have not been of any use to me, really, in helping. But my depression started about 2 weeks after I had major female surgery, and my hormones all disappeared. I was about 50 years old at the time, and I did not have any cancer, and I wanted only a hysterectomy done, but they proceeded and removed my ovaries also, even though they were not cancerous either, and that really upsets me to this day.
I would imagine. And to this day, have you found ways to be that help you in really dealing with the depression that you've had for 20 years?
I know all the right things that I'm supposed to do, and I've been through up to the old-fashioned psychotherapy to cognitive therapy to biofeedback. I've even taken classes in biofeedback and many classes in psychology, and I pretty much know the routine after 20 years. But talking is what helps me the most.
Interesting. And you probably have a book to write as well.
Probably. But I've been in abusive situations, but for long periods of time, but they did not really seem to make me depressed. Mm-hmm. And it was not until I started crying and what have you about 2 weeks after. I've also been a nurse for 30 years.
So you're very knowledgeable. You're self-aware.
Yeah.
You've tried many things. Do you have a particular question? I appreciate everything that you've offered right now just to share your story, but I just want to make sure. Did you have a question for our guest?
Well, I would like to... there's a new documentary out that was mentioned on one of your interviews on Against the Grain the other day, called it's called Bipolarized. It's about a young man that had been diagnosed with as a bipolar,
yes,
and was on lithium for 17 years and then decided to do research to try and get off of it, and all that he went through to get off of the medication. So I would like to get off of, I'm back to just Prozac now and Ativan. So,
okay. And you're still interested in figuring out how to be off medication, and if there's something else that might be helpful. Can I say that? Does that sound right for moving on? Okay.
Yeah, again,
let me ask our guests about that, Diane.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, I really appreciate you calling and sharing what you did, because I immediately go to the hormone piece, and I want to ask Dr. Turai about that.
Yeah, I think it's really telling, Diana, that you mentioned it seems to have been triggered after your ovaries were removed.
Well, it's trauma as well.
Yeah, it's trauma, and it's a major it's a major biochemical trigger. Our brain definitely has receptors for estrogen and progesterone and all the other hormones in the body, and so if you abruptly remove that, it can certainly have an impact on the way you think, the way you feel. Women who are entering menopause know this, and for them it's a little more gradual usually, but for you to have that abrupt removal makes one wonder, is there a hormonal, could hormones have been replaced in a case such as yours to help you feel better? I don't know if that was done, but certainly it points to one of the many biochemical roots of anxiety, depression, is hormone imbalance. You have the major sex hormones, progesterone, estrogen, testosterone, and then you have the thyroid hormones. You have the adrenal hormones, all of which can be out of whack and all of which can be supported
And I ask you, so even at this time, 20 years later, would you say, again, we can't make diagnoses and we can't give individual advice, but would you say it would be important to make sure some of those testing is done for hormone imbalance at this point?
I would definitely consider it. Yeah. You know, it would be a good thing to ask your doctor about, see if there's any deficiencies or any low normal hormones, and then do some very judicious trials with someone who's skilled in using hormones.
Yeah,
possibly. Yes, yeah, definitely an option.
And David, I think it's really, again, validating to hear Diane say that also talking is a big part of what helps her. She does so much. You know, she's learned so much.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, first of all, Diane, I mean, I'm sorry for your suffering and for your experience, because, you know, some people do not respond to any medications. And I've had this experience in my practice where there are people that, you know, who are really suffering, and nothing is that helpful in terms of the pharmaceutical industry. And I do think that while talk cannot cure, if there's such a concept that really exists, all disorders or problems, it can certainly make them more bearable, and it can, you know, incrementally improve a person's situation and their ability to tolerate suffering and process what's happened to them and feel connected. And that can, that's a big thing.
And I think that's where a lot of people I know have gone in the direction of saying, what brings me happiness? What brings me joy and comfort? Is it music? Is it art? Is it getting out into nature? I know so many people say they feel depressed, they go out into nature, and it shifts for them. Right. You know, is it making sure they have exercise, being with friends? So there is this whole way in which people can write down or evaluate, what is it that makes a difference in my life? Because we are looking sometimes of not saying I'm getting rid of this propensity towards depression, but I'm finding ways to add to my life so that's meaningful. Yeah. Let's take another call. We have Una from Sevastopol with us. You're on About Health.
Hi. So I have a 35 years background in the medical field, and also had three cancers. And so one of the things that has been present for me, one is that I reversed cancer totally alternatively the last time. It was the easiest. But I use, you know, since then, I work with people with a lot of different kind of disease. And what I work with are technologies that most people haven't heard about it. So I'm going to name them and describe shortly what they are. One is called redox signaling molecules.
Can you say that again? I didn't follow that.
It's called redox signaling molecules.
Redox signaling molecules, yeah.
So redox signaling molecules are made by the mitochondria, and they decrease as we age. And they can do different things. One, they can penetrate into the blood-brain barrier and reverse a lot of oxidation and do different things in the body. So that's one. And I'm happy to, you know, to give some places where you can learn more things. The other one that I have come across and I work with is actually a woman who had a near-death experience and was downloaded with a mathematics of the universe. And so mathematics, when you look at inflammation, at hormones, at all those things, they have a certain mathematical signature. And you can actually, so she was sent back, you know, to bring back this technology. And I work all the time with people all around the world. And
why don't you give us the resource, Una, so if people are interested in finding out about both the redox signaling molecules and the way the mathematics works, it would be really wonderful if you have a website or a place where people can learn more.
I'll give it to you at the end, but let me finish a piece. So a lot of things also with depression, some is inherited in our genetic.
Yes.
Some is also, you can see with human design, which is the third thing that I work with, because I found that people who are sick – usually I'm not doing what they love to do.
I like that idea that human design looks at people who are sick sometimes are not doing what they're meant to do, and so part of your work is to help them with that, it sounds like.
And I would actually jump in with the idea that, in depression, a lot of times, one of the big symptoms is what we call anhedonia, which means a loss of pleasure in ordinary activities that might normally give you pleasure. And a lot of times when I'm talking to people, one of the things that I listen for is, you know, what do you enjoy? What gives you pleasure? What do you what about your life can you take pleasure in? And in cases of severe depression, you could have an instance where somebody doesn't get pleasure from anything.
Yeah. And Una, I'm going to the reason I'm going to cut you off a little bit is we have a whole bunch of calls waiting. So wrap up what you're saying for us. It's very interesting, and I also would love you to give a resource.
Okay, my phone number is 707.
You know, people, I don't think people will call you. I'd rather not give out your phone number.
www.unamourier.com. unamourier.com. And there is lots of information on how to reach me. And you can read about those different modalities.
That's beautiful. And I'll say that again. unamourier.com. So we have a lot of people who have a lot of wisdom out there with different ideas and successes. I mean, even Una said that she was able to reverse her cancer. So thank you for that call. We have Adrian now from Katate. You're on About Health.
I wanted to say a couple things about getting off drugs, because I think we often underestimate how hard it is to get off psych drugs. They are really powerful, and sometimes the withdrawal from them and the, I guess, addiction level, I'm not sure if that's technically correct, but they cause some of the same symptoms that they're supposed to cure. Mm-hmm. So as you try to get off of them, you feel panic attacks, you get hallucinations, you feel suicidal. And really, it needs to be titrated really, really carefully.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes the alternative folks don't know how that is, and we need to really be careful. I am so in favor of people getting off their drugs and decreasing them if they can. But the truth is, we need some Western medicine people to step up in a very big way and make themselves available for this work, because it's very, very hard to find someone who will monitor it and do it safely with you.
Absolutely. Adrian, I want to jump in. This is Dr. Tarai, and I think you make a really, really good point about being very careful about titrating down slowly. And many, you know, many prescribers are not even aware of how difficult it can be for patients. Certainly when someone comes to me wanting to do that, like I said, it's essential that they're working closely with their psychiatrist and to do a very, very slow taper. And there's nutritional things that can be done to offset the trauma to the brain that can happen when you come off antidepressants. There does seem to be some sort of withdrawal. There's a tolerance that the brain has to the biochemical effect of the medication. So you make a really good point, and more people need to be aware of that. I've had patients whose doctors have been very casual about having them reduce their medication dose and have had really big problems with it. And the frustrating thing is, for some patients, is they're not believed that, you know, the reduction in dose has impacted them that deeply. And you can have things like the brain zaps, you know, the an onset of anxiety or even psychotic symptoms from reducing medication. So it's a really great point.
Yes. Thank you so much for saying that, Adrian. I appreciate it. Anything else, David, on that?
No, I agree with Tarai. I think she's right on about that.
Yeah, good. Let's take more calls then. Looks like we have next is Maria from Oakland. You're on About Health. Hi, Maria.
Great show, and I'm actually calling just, okay, this is a little critique, feedback. I think it's ironic that you have the director of the Wright Institute there.
No, I don't.
No, I'm saying because called there last week.
He's not the director of the Wright Institute, no.
He does something at the Wright Institute.
At one point.
If I could jump in, I supervise trainees there. Maybe one a year that, you know, they're studying to become psychologists, so I meet with them and, you know, review their clinical work with them.
No, I just was saying because I actually am trying to get a personal therapist. I was in a group with two of the Rite Institute trainee people, and our group ended, and they referred me there for individual counseling to try to find a therapist for individual self-talk, and I have never received a call back.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I'm really sorry, too. You know, I would urge you to, I'm sure we can come up with a number or something for the clinic, but, you know, I am really sorry that that happened.
No, that's okay. I have the number, but...
And call them back and give them that feedback, because when someone needs, you know, that kind of support, it feels awful, you know, when someone doesn't return your call. Was there something else, Maria?
Also, I wanted to just say that I am similar to the woman who called two calls before with having tried medication, and I've also asked for, my preference would be to, as a last resort, go there because I've tried it in the past and it hasn't really helped. And I do realize I feel an anti-inflammatory diet does work for me, but when I've mentioned that to a psychiatrist, for example, they don't believe it, and at the same time just want to prescribe medication. And when I say, well, in the past I was told I needed hormone replacement for thyroid from having Kaiser insurance way back when, and it was never given to me once I lost my Kaiser and went elsewhere for insurance, and not being taken seriously, where we know our own bodies and we can tell when we're in that fog or something's out of whack, and there might be something going on that is just something a little easier, like change your diet, change exposure to different foods or chemicals or who knows what, and then go the medication route. But go to a psychiatrist and you have your blood work results with you and they don't even want to look at them, and they're just like, I'm just here to prescribe medication. I don't need to look at that.
It's a system that is really on its head.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you brought this up too, because, you know, it's complicated. Sometimes thyroid disease will show the same symptoms of depression.
Absolutely.
There are so many ways in which we need good practitioners to pay attention, and part of our job is to be advocates for ourselves, but it's rough. It takes a lot of energy to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in a lot of ways the organ, you know, to compartmentalize the body into discrete organs as if they don't interact with each other is incredibly outdated. It's a model that's on the way out. Patients know, you know, patients with chronic disease know it doesn't work. More and more doctors are realizing this. As a naturopathic doctor, we've always looked at things from a holistic perspective, and holistic means that you consider the whole person. You consider that the gut is intimately related with all of the organs. You consider that the thyroid hormone has an impact on the brain, that the adrenals have an impact on the brain, the sex hormones have an impact on the brain. It's incredibly frustrating not to have that recognized by your doctor. So I'm sorry you had to go through that, and I commend you for continuing to advocate for yourself.
Thank you, Maria. You're listening to About Health. I'm your host, Rona Renner, and my guests are Dr. David Frankel. He's a clinical psychologist, and Dr. Tarai Kunishi. She's a naturopathic doctor. We're having a conversation about depression, what it is, what treatments work, how you bring yourself back to a place of happiness or joy, and also what are some of the barriers. And we take your call at toll-free 1-800-958-900. And I also know that there are people who are more sensitive to all the disparities in our society, and there's a way in which that can bring a lot of grief or depression. Mm-hmm. And also, I think there's also people who are disenfranchised and don't get the kind of support they need. So there's a lot to talk about, and I also want to make sure we get to some treatments and other treatments in terms of sort of making a plan for your life and what you need to help pull yourself out of bed in the morning. Let's, though, take another call because we do have people waiting. It looks like we have Colonto. You're on the line with us.
Hello.
Yes, I'm not sure if I said your name right.
You said it right.
Oh, okay. Yeah, what's
your
question?
I just wanted to echo a little bit of what Maria just said, that I too thought I was going through some sort of depression, and what it was my thyroid. And luckily, my doctor was able to catch it, whereas from once you find this, you start doing research, and other doctors are not catching it, but I think just regular medical doctors are now becoming more aware of it because this is becoming more and more common, people having hypo. And it was not until I started getting on this, you know, the hormone replacement.
Yes.
I was going to therapy, and I could have gone to therapy, you know, once a week for a whole year, and it wouldn't help because it was the chemical makeup of the body, and it just everything you guys just said prior to coming on the air is all true.
Yes.
So as an individual, if you have any of these symptoms, you should bring it to attention to your doctor and ask to be tested for your T levels, your hormone levels, or whatever it is, because they may not do it.
That's right. They may not do it, and they may not do enough of it. Sometimes they'll do. I have thyroid disease also, and so sometimes they'll just do what's a thyroid stimulating hormone, TSH. The TSH, mm-hmm. But they need to do TSH and T3 and T4, and then you even have to go sometimes to another doctor, a functional medicine doctor, to get your antibodies tested.
Right.
So yeah, we have to really push hard for that. I appreciate you bringing that up, David.
Yeah, I think you're making a really excellent point. In a broader sense, I also have thyroid problems, interestingly enough, but that not just with regard to thyroid, but a lot of physical or other conditions can mimic depression. And it's very important to work with somebody who takes the time to build a relationship with you, take a long history, to look at every dimension of your life from a holistic perspective, because it's easy to miss other things. Drugs and alcohol can mimic depression.
Yes.
Other physical conditions can mimic depression.
Sexual abuse.
Sexual
abuse.
You
have PTSD.
Yeah, you know, and so I think it's really important to, what I try to do is to tolerate being confused for a while.
Yes.
When I meet somebody, because you can miss things. And, you know, anyway, thanks for calling in. That's a really good point.
Thank you. Good show.
Yes,
thank you.
Wish you well. Let's take another call. We have Bob from San Francisco, it looks like. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for the program. You've obviously touched the nerve. So here's my question. Can you talk a little bit about depression and aging? We've got a baby boomer generation that's now in their 70s, and you sort of, how do you come to terms with getting older? We've spent time, whole lifetime working, and everybody who works looks forward to retirement, but
not everybody
knows how to.
Right. My husband says, I was tired and now I'm retired.
and you have to confront the void.
Right.
But, for some people, retirement means you don't have good benefits and you're struggling to just get by financially. But
that's
even right. If that's not the issue, it's sort of, how do you make sense of your life? How do you come to terms with, the closer prospect of dying, or just, the physical things like, the essential tremors that mean you have to enter your password several times or walking into a room and forgetting why you went there and saying, is this the beginnings of dementia? That kind of stuff.
Yes, Bob, that's a great point. And I think the other piece I also think about is relationships. You know, sometimes people leave their quote-unquote job and suddenly they don't have the same relationships they've had before and have to start over building those relationships. Let me see what my guests have to say. David?
Sure. I mean, I think it's a great question. And I think the existential dimension of this is really important because for many of us, work is really a big part of our identity. It's how we define ourselves. It's how we feel useful in the world. And when you take that away or cut it back, you know, something has to replace it. And I do think that in order to be happy in retirement or as an older person, it's important to have meaning. And I don't necessarily even mean through making money, although, it's nice if you can do that. But through whatever works in your life, I mean, the three components of happiness that you mentioned, Tarai, I think, those are as applicable in older age as they are.
Definitely.
For everybody.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in too because I think the aging question is really key, and especially as someone who is bicultural, I grew up in the Philippines, I'm now a resident of the U.S., and I just see a difference in the way we look at aging in the two different cultures. The United States is very much, a youth-oriented culture, both for men and also especially for women. You see the movies where you have, 50-something males with 20-year-old, females, it makes aging have that dimension of, a loss of value.
Right.
A loss of relevance, a loss of beauty, and that can be incredibly harmful to someone who is really invested in that youthful identity. Whereas in Asia, in the Philippines, for example, older people are afforded a lot of respect.
Wisdom. They're seen as being wise.
Absolutely. So
cared for.
Yeah, cared for. They they're just given so much more respect for what they've been through, and such a healthier approach to aging, I think.
That's a great point. I see that in the Native American cultures, mm-hmm. as well as even in some of the Latin cultures, yes. and in South America, other places where you get older and you're really valued. And I think feeling valued and important helps to counter the depression.
Absolutely.
And I worked in nursing homes for a long time, and one of the things that was lacking was a sense of children in your life and mm-hmm. animals in your life, mm-hmm. and other beings in your life of multi-generational experience. So I think we do it wrong here when it comes to aging. And so I think anyone who is facing that within themselves needs to think about how do I keep finding that meaning, and how do I keep connecting with people or animals or nature that's important. And I loved his question, and we should do a whole show about that for sure.
Yeah.
Let's take another call. We have Elizabeth with us from Berkeley. You're on About Health.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Elizabeth. I have chemical sensitivities, and mm-hmm. I'm wondering how the heck are we supposed to survive with this and not be incredibly bummed out and depressed? I am planning a move to Mendocino County to go to the coast and sell my home in Berkeley and get the heck out of here, because I'm so sick from the dioxins and the petroleum, you know, the laundry products, the fireplaces, the mm-hmm. bonfires, the wood-burning smoke. The other day, someone did laundry, and I guess the dryer sheets and all the fabrics, all the combination of stuff they used pretty much knocked me out, and I almost collapsed.
Yeah.
So what about the environmental stuff, and why in Berkeley is this even legal? Why are we hurting children or getting asthma? What are we supposed to do if we can't just suddenly flee and get out? How are we supposed to, you know, gas lawnmowers, they're actually legal here.
Thank you,
how
Elizabeth.
Are we supposed to deal with the chemicals?
I'm sorry that for you in particular, you know, you have to leave because of it, and you know, I hope that you find a place, especially if there isn't too much mold. I know mm-hmm. sometimes when people go too far too north in the coast, there's the dampness also brings that. But let me see what Trey has to say.
Well, you know, for chemically sensitive patients, it is incredibly difficult. We live in a polluted world. You know, every day chemicals can be extremely devastating to your energy, to your well-being. So there's two pieces. You know, one is obviously avoiding as much as possible the toxins and the pollution. The other piece is addressing the potential, you know, toxicity or buildup in your own body. You know, the way in which your liver is burdened by the foods you're eating. So a clean diet is going to be incredibly important. Some people look into heavy metals. When you get into chemical sensitivity, you're at this state where you can have a systemic inflammatory response that might not even be associated anymore with the original trigger. And so it sometimes takes a lot of time, a lot of patience with slowly allowing the body to come back to balance. But I just want to point one more thing, which is one of the most exciting findings in chronic disease is the activity of the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve is a nerve that goes through the whole body, and it's a key part of the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the rest and relax and digest nervous system. It's important because they find that when the vagus nerve is active, it brings down inflammation all over the body, so much so that when they stimulated the vagus nerve in arthritis patients, they were able to reduce their medication significantly. And I say that because when you cannot control your environment, all you have is yourself. And so the degree to which you can bring down your own stress level, the degree to which you can connect, that's a powerful vagus nerve activator.
And so you're saying rest also.
Rest, sleep, relax, sleep, connect. Mindfulness has been found to activate vagus nerve, exercise. So there are things you can control within your own environment that can bring down your response.
Thank you for that. And I think that's really important for all of us. David, you wanted to say something there. I was thinking, David, you work with people who they come to you and they have so many different life stories. And you, like you said before, you have to look and see where can we go to figure out how to bring this more mindful, self-compassionate, self-care approach. And so, you know, there are people who are dealing with chronic illness, the death of a loved person, a loved one, not able to find work, can't afford housing. You know, we have listeners who are in prison who are listening. Mm-hmm. There's a situation that, you know, you can't control your environment.
Right.
So I think also a lot of your work is to try and help people figure out what they can control.
You know, I would describe it somewhat, as the, the therapeutic use of grief in some ways, because there are painful realities that we all face and that a number of people, you know, some people much more than others, and that they are realities that sometimes we can't impact and, despite our best efforts, and that the value of psychotherapy is to help to grieve some of those things, whether it's aging and the loss of one's capacities and the death of one's loved ones or one's environment that you can't necessarily always change, that to try to do what you can to accept and grieve the reality, the painful reality that's in front of you, so that the good things that are there can be enjoyed.
That's really important. You know, I had hip replacement surgery a year and a half ago or so, and I don't suffer from depression. It's not something I know internally. I know it from friends and other people, but I don't know it myself. But after my hip surgery, I felt down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I was in grief of, like, feeling helpless and not being able to do the things I wanted to do. So I got a taste of what that's like. And I think you're really touching on the importance of grief, which is acceptance.
Yes.
It's real deep acceptance of my situation, who I am, what's up for me, lowering expectations from the outside world, being willing to ask for help, and reducing shame and blame.
Yeah.
You know, like this real stew that we have to mix up around, you know, how do we really accept ourselves and know what we're going through? It's really important.
And I would say one of the real toxic elements of that is guilt and self-blame, because there are times where you just don't have control over certain things and you feel as if you should, and you can blame yourself, and that can very easily kind of spiral into depression.
Absolutely. And, you know, before we run out of time, I want to mention that, you know, if you're someone who feels like you're in a place where you're really down and don't know how to get help and don't know what to do, and, you know, if you've struggled with suicidal thoughts, there is a 24-hour hotline that I just always want to mention. It's 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. And you can also just go online and say 24-hour hotline. There's also a crisis text line. There's all kinds of help out there. And so know that even if it means talking to someone who you don't know on the phone, that might be the way to begin your therapeutic process. So I want a final word from you, Tere Kanishi.
Whatever you're going through right now, I really want to echo what has been said here about the first step is really accepting where you're at. Sometimes it's the denial or the running away from what you're experiencing prolongs the process and makes it harder to go through. So accept what you're going through. Find help. There are solutions out there. Don't give up hope.
And Tarai Kanishi's website is
deeplyhappy.com.
And David Frankel's website is
davidfrankelphd.com.
Thank you both so much for being here. It was really interesting. I learned a lot, and I really felt like our callers had a lot to offer us as well. So I thank
Thanks
all
for
of
having
you.
Us.
You're welcome. I thank all of you for listening, and I'll be back in a few weeks. But in the meantime, you can reach me at my website at nurserona.com, and you can email me from there. My gratitude to our board operator, Erica Bridgman. And my wish for you is that you be healthy, happy, and live with peace and with ease. This is Nurse Rona saying goodbye.
I'm Casey Weaver of Context for the Visionary Activist Show, a show that aspires to wed spiritual magic and conscious, compassionate social activism. Join us every Thursday at 2 p.m. as we invoke and implement a more ingeniously cooperative and reverent world.
Consider producing a community radio show? If that's the case, please pay attention. The Pacifica National Board has approved a motion to implement 5 new hours of programming in Spanish per week at every station of Pacifica, which includes Houston, Los Angeles, Berkeley, Washington, D.C., and New York. If you or someone you know is interested, please send us an email to programacion-espanol@pacifica.org or visit your local Pacifica radio website. Pacifica speaks Spanish.
And you're listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3.